Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the capture of a priceless World Heritage Site, the ancient city of Palmyra in Syria, by the self-proclaimed Islamic State. We will speak with UCLA historian James Gelvin, whose research focuses on the Middle East and in particular Greater Syria, and discuss the likelihood that the ancient Roman ruins in Palmyra will be the next victim of the desecration and destruction of antiquities by the terrorist group whose ideological justification for such barbarity against human history is found in Saudi Wahhabi doctrine. Then we'll look into the ruling by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that will decide whether the controversial Diablo Canyon nuclear plant was illegally allowed to alter the plant's license in an attempt to hide its vulnerability to earthquake faults only 3.5 miles offshore, and one that is less than 1,000 feet from the ocean water intake that cools the plant with 2.5 billion gallons of seawater per day. The former head of the TVA, New York Power, the LADWP, and the California State Energy Czar, David Freeman, a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations, joins us. Then finally, following the $5.8 billion fines against five big banks for fixing markets, we will look into the disconnect between claiming success for penalizing too-big-to-fail banks without jailing too-big-to-jail bankers, while the Republican Congress cuts enforcement funds for the IRS and the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, joins us to discuss the $1 trillion per year in revenues owed to the federal government that is not collected. And joining us now is James Gelvin, who is a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History, and his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Gelvin.
Thank you for having me.
And this World Heritage Site at Palmyra is an extraordinary place, and I'm just haunted by the idea that these people who have destroyed so many antiquities in Iraq and go back to the destruction of the Buddhas in Bamiyan in Afghanistan as well, since the Taliban also are influenced by Saudi Wahhabi ideology, as is the Islamic State. The portent's not good, is it?
No, it's not. And, first of all, this site is, as you say, an extraordinary site and well deserves its status as a world history, a world culture site. The thing, though, that about it, which is very, very important, though, is that it's not only representative of for the various groups, ISIS in particular, a pagan heritage, but it also has been resurrected as part of the national heritage of Syria itself, of the secular state of Syria. In other words, the secular state of Syria, which is brand new, has used this site on its currency, on its postage stamps, even on its coins, as a way of ensuring that Syrians get the understanding that they are a true nation that stretches all the way back in history.
Well, the Wahhabi ideology, though, is I think at the root of why they're destroying these things. I mean, Mecca and Medina was destroyed by the Wahhabis. So do you think that given that this is important to the state, that's extra impetus for them for the Islamic State to destroy Palmyra?
Yes. Yes, I think it is. I think it's a thumb in the eye to the state and to the secular nationalists as well, including secular nationalists who are members of the opposition. But you're absolutely right. The Saudis consider all sorts of sites like this, the Wahhabis, Saudis, various other groupings, consider sites like this to be idolatrous. And so, therefore, they're very interested in ensuring that these sites are off-limits or destroyed.
Well, interesting enough, they are, they were considered by the early Christians to be idolatrous too, weren't they? It's sort of a miracle they survived.
Well, one thing that people have tended to talk about a lot has been, why hasn't there been an Islamic Reformation? And you should be careful what you wish for, because the closest of the groupings that is actually closest to the Salafis is actually Martin Luther and the Protestant reformers during the Reformation. They were the ones who destroyed the icons, what they considered to be Catholic icons. They were the ones who went back to the original sources. So it's six of one, half dozen of another. You really have to be careful what you want.
And isn't there a big prison, one of the Assad's worst prisons in the neighborhood? Is that being liberated?
Well, the prison has been liberated. We assume the prison has been liberated. It was taken over. And yes, it was a horrific site. It was a site of a massacre during the previous Muslim Brotherhood uprising, and was one of the triggers, actually, to sparking a virtual civil war in 1982.
So that's the Tadmor prison, but I understand that there also people were trapped there. The Syrian army wouldn't let civilians leave, and then once they fled, civilians were able to leave, but a lot of civilians weren't able to leave, and now ISIS is going door-to-door killing people that they don't approve of.
This is typical of ISIS. I mean, what ISIS does is it works on the principle that Lenin once enunciated, which is that the purpose of terrorism is to terrorize. And so they're doing this. They've done this before. They did it in Ramadi, for example. There have been reports of the killing of children simply because they were children of resistance fighters. So it's very likely that they are doing this sort of thing as well. It destroys the enemy. It destroys the enemy's morale. It builds an esprit de corps among the jihadis. And many of the foreign jihadis who have joined ISIS are what we call in Los Angeles gangbangers. They like nothing better than to wreck whatever havoc they possibly can.
And again, I'm speaking with James Galvin, who's a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. And he's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism, and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. So clearly, the noose is closing around Assad and his regime, it would seem, that he is suffering considerable military setbacks. If it weren't for the Iranians, he would have been out of business a long time ago. That's at least my understanding. So, but on the other hand, if I were a Syrian Christian or an Alawite, I'd be fearful of my life if these guys take over. They'll massacre you, won't they?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's not one or the other. It's not the Assad regime or ISIS. There are plenty of other groups on the ground, and there's also international actors that would want to ensure that those other groups are empowered. But there's a couple of things that we really have to step back and think about. I mean, 2 years ago, it was so evident that the regime had virtually destroyed the resistance. Now it's the resistance that is destroying the regime. This is a roller coaster. We're going up and down on this. There's no way of determining, you know, basically what's going to happen. The second thing that we have to be aware of is the fact that every time the regime loses territory, loses men, the Iranians pump in a lot more heavy equipment, men, and, you know, capabilities for the regime. So it's one of those things that the regime could be have large-scale setbacks, but something that's very indicative of what's going on is that there's been execution of high-level officials in Damascus who oppose the Iranians playing such a prominent role. What this means is that the inner core of the regime has decided we will pull out all stops, which means that we will let the Iranians do whatever they have to do to crush this rebellion as it now stands.
And the Iranians are basically using Hezbollah as boots on the ground, aren't they?
Yes. I mean, they're both acting in coordination, of course. Hezbollah has one major advantage over the Iranians in as much as that they're native Arabic speakers, and so therefore can actually set up these self-defense units that are protecting Alawite villages and Christian villages in the western part of Syria.
So at this point, though, in terms of this World Heritage Site at Palmyra, there's not much that can be done to save it, I take it. I mean, we've seen what the Islamic State has done to UNESCO World Heritage Sites in Iraq. So I guess we have to prepare for the worst here, do we?
I think we do. I mean, the only hope that there actually is to probably keep them off guard long enough so that they can't go about the acts of destruction. Now, what they did in Nineveh was they removed the stuff that could be sold on the black market and pretty much destroyed the stuff that was too big to transport out of the country. You know, the stuff that there's there in Palmyra is not the small artifacts. Those are already put into museums or have been stashed away to prevent either the opposition or ISIS from taking control of them. Now what you have is these huge monuments. You have this colonnade, for example, that is extraordinarily long. You have a temple of Bel, you have a temple of Baal. You have a whole bunch of things that, you know, would represent a serious loss of our understanding of who we are, how we got here, if they're lost.
But when you mentioned earlier that the Assad regime is now murdering the senior officers who oppose the increasing influence of Iran, that's fairly indicative of a kind of instability at the top. So the Assads are pretty ruthless. They have their Mubaharat and the Maha, the brother, runs the Republican Guards. Mm-hmm. So is this a kind of combination of, have they sort of formed a joint venture with the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and the Quds Force and basically killed everybody that doesn't agree with them? There's no opposition that post Assad opposition that could be used in a transition that's secular and rational.
I once gave a talk at the Center for Strategic and International Studies with Steve Heidemann, who's a very smart individual. He works for the American Institute for Peace. And I made the statement that there is virtually no chance of the regime turning on itself. There is no chance of, for example, people kicking out Bashar al-Assad. He made a smarter comment, and he said there's one chance of that happening. If the regime thinks that somebody like Bashar al-Assad is buckling, is about to give in, they will remove them. This is exactly what's happening. This doesn't show regime instability. It's being read that way. It doesn't show regime instability. What it shows is the fact that the regime is actually circling its wagons even tighter, eliminating those elements that it feels might be prone to possible negotiation or compromise, and instead is saying, okay, look, we're going to continue our policy, which is going all out.
So is there a solution here? There's no diplomatic solution, obviously, as long as Iran and Russia support him, and as you say, he's not going anywhere, and his back's against the wall, and he's not going to give in, and he doesn't care how many of his own citizens die in the process. I had heard reports that the U.S. had sort of prepared for a second Syrian war after this one ends, where they may actually introduce boots on the ground to round up and kill all of these Islamic State people. Have you heard anything to that effect? I mean, it sounds at this point, from what you just told us, they may not get to that point for some time.
Well, I think what's going to happen is the following. I think in terms of the Islamic State will probably be destroyed in Iraq and degraded in Syria. The question of the Islamic State in Iraq is the fact that, you know, at this point, it's made some substantial gains in the last week or so. But again, we can't do this roller coaster thing and look at it this way. It's got inherent weaknesses within it, within its financing, within its ability to supply, its the areas that it's taken over. It's attracting the wrong sort of people. And what you have is it was able to take over, let's say, the soft underbelly of Anbar of the Sunni provinces. That's the case. But what will likely happen is a political agreement will be reached in Iraq that will allow for the destruction of ISIS there. In Syria, there is no possibility that will occur because there is no government that could broker such an agreement. And what that means is that Syria will be divided on a permanent basis among a variety of we should call them gangs because that's what they really are, among a variety of gangs, all of which are fighting over turf, the most important turf being the turf in the East, actually, the oil-producing turf, because that's how they can finance themselves. Under those circumstances, what we'll see is this sort of like instability, this sort of stalemate, but instability, a constant fighting, low-level sort of like fighting taking place. There's about 125,000 people now who are militias. There's about 1,000 different militias in Syria. So it's a very, very unstable situation. One activist has called what's going on in Syria right now Mad Max meets the Sopranos. And if you remember back to the Mad Max movies or the new Mad Max movie, the whole purpose of what was going on in this post-apocalyptic world was to seize control of the oil fields. And that's exactly what's going on in Syria right now.
Well, James Galvin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with James Galvin, who's a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He is the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism, and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History, and his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the licensing of the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant that the NRC is now revisiting.
In this sacred land, it has seen many hands. It has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old. And now the greedy souls just don't care to know of the changes it will confront. So speak out loud of the things you are proud of. Love this coast, then keep it clean as it holds. Cause the way that it shines may just dwindle with time, with the changes it will confront.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Freeman, who is a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He has had the ear of federal officials since the days of JFK and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under Jimmy Carter and also headed New York Power and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and was the state energy czar responsible for rescuing California from the predations of Enron and Company. David Freeman is the author of Winning Our Energy Independence, and Energy Insider Shows How. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Freeman.
Well, it's good to be with you, even though I'm maybe 3,000 miles away.
Well, you were just out here, and you know, since you left, or maybe you were still here.
Well,
you know, this.
I needed another drink of water, so I had to go east to get one. So.
Well, you could drink oil now if you're in Santa Barbara. I mean, there's a terrible oil spill in Santa Barbara as a result of this Texas company.
Let me just say, I was in the Nixon White House when the first oil spill hit in Santa Barbara, and that really ushered in the environmental revolution, even in the Nixon administration. And I still remember it like it was yesterday. As a result, the rules about drilling were dramatically changed, and the EPA was created, the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act. Santa Barbara paid a big price, but that oil spill ignited. It didn't ignite, thank God, but I mean, it started the major environmental revolution, and even Republican Nixon administration took notice when that happened.
And, of course, it also began Earth Day. But what's so ironic, David Freeman, is that the oil spill is on exactly the same stretch of beaches that
It proves a very simple point I've been trying to make, that we have to keep it in the ground. You know, if Mother Nature expected us to burn oil, she would have made it a hell of a lot easier for us to attain it. You know, we ought to just leave it alone. You know, we now have the sun and the wind and storage, and everything new should be renewable, and we should phase out oil and gas. And Mother Nature is trying to tell us in every way she can that we need to get off of it. And I must say that what really kind of breaks your heart is we have a Democratic president who is just got through approving drilling for more oil in the pristine Arctic and offering new leases offshore Atlantic, when his slogan should be keep it in the ground.
Well, you know, obviously these companies like the Plains All American Company, the pipeline company that's been fined on a huge number of occasions, has made, I think its annual profits is 40-something billion. The oil company's profits are unbelievable. Obviously, this is about money buying politicians to protect the status quo, regardless of the scientific evidence that global warming is the greatest threat the planet faces.
Yes, but let me say that there's a threat equally awesome that we have tended to forget about, and that's sitting up there in San Luis Obispo. It's a nuclear power plant that is now over 30 years old, and where three additional earthquake faults have been discovered since it was licensed, and one was discovered during the licensing. In other words, we now have scientific evidence that the power plant is not designed to stand up to the kind of earthquakes that even the seismologists are now predicting could happen. And, of course, they don't know for sure how big it's going to be. The one in Japan was three times as big as anyone predicted. So while we do have pictures of a black beach to remind us of the dangers of fossil fuels, and we have a lot of discussion about climate, the Friends of the Earth that I'm advising is having a difficult time reminding people that while we're trying to get the climate issue under control, we may suffer a disaster from a nuclear power plant that now can be replaced economically with solar, wind, and storage. And so I'm a senior advisor to Friends of the Earth, and we are campaigning to try to wake up the people of California and its elected public officials, and hopefully even the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, to doing something in a timely fashion. And it can't hurt, because we can replace it with electricity that's not only safe and clean, but over time will be cheaper.
And again, I'm speaking with David Freeman, a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He has had the ear of federal officials since the days of JFK and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under Jimmy Carter, and also headed New York Power and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and was the state energy czar responsible for rescuing California from the predations of Enron and company. David Freeman is the author of Winning Our Energy Independence, and Energy Insider shows how. So let's talk about what the NRC is now moving on. They basically will decide whether Pacific Gas and Electric Company, the owners of Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant, was allowed to illegally alter the plant's license in an attempt to hide the risk from powerful earthquake faults discovered since it was designed and built. And as you mentioned, there's one fault, the Hosgreave Fault, discovered in 1971. That's 3.5 miles offshore. But the Shoreline Fault, discovered in 2008, is less than 1,000 feet from the ocean water intake structure for the plant itself.
Let me say that the news this morning from the NRC will probably be spun by PG&E as saying that they turned down our petition. Well, they didn't turn down our petition. They have done something that is fairly dramatic. They have referred the heart of our case to an independent licensing board. So for the first time in the since 1984, which is a fairly long time ago, my recollection, some 30 years ago, we will have an independent body of experts that will hear our case about whether the plant can withstand the kind of earthquakes that we've discovered since 1984. And so this is a kind of a, in the world of nuclear regulation, a kind of a breakthrough, shall we say, a ray of radioactive sunshine. We're actually going to have a chance to present independent evidence to an independent hearing board as to whether the plant is an outlaw plant operating outside its license or not. And this is, I think, a breakthrough, because there are a lot of good people that are probably listening to this program that have been lobbying and urging that Diablo Canyon be shut down for the last 30 years. And I think this is the first time that we've got even a toehold into trying to get someone with an open mind to listen to us. Of course, we do have cases pending before the California Public Utilities Commission, but their jurisdiction goes to the economics, which is another story, and they are forbidden to consider safety by the federal law that preempts that. So we're feeling that this may, at long last, be the beginning of the end of Diablo Canyon, because we scored a similar victory in the San Onofre fight, almost identical, and the licensing board held in our favor, and that decision was actually cited by Ted Craver, the chairman of the Edison Company, and is one of the reasons why they decided to shut the plant down. So we have a sense of encouragement and fight that we can wage here today. But it's a fight on behalf of the whole state of California, because the danger of this plant, depending on which way the wind blows, could affect millions of people. The entire Central Valley is within short range of, and it's not just the plant itself, it's the radioactive trash, they call it spent fuel, that's left over, and it's been piling up for 30 years, you know. The nuclear trash man that was supposed to take this stuff away to a safe place, well, he or she never showed up. You know why? Because there ain't no safe place. They've been looking for 50 years to find one, and nobody wants it. And so the only answer really is birth control. We've got to stop making this stuff. Because it's, to my mind, actually a moral issue of whether we continue to make electricity from stuff that is going to be radioactive and be radioactive for hundreds of thousands of years, especially when, you know, our ingenuity has reached the point where solar power is cheaper than this stuff, and wind power, and we have large batteries and even better batteries coming down the road to store it in so that we can have reliable around-the-clock power from the sun and the wind. You know, the interesting thing is that the technology is moving ahead, and we just need to get the decision makers to catch up with what our scientists and engineers have perfected.
So the Atomic Safety Licensing Board that's going to decide whether PG&E allowed to illegally alter the plant's license in an attempt to hide the risk from earthquake faults that were discovered since it was designed, but I guess, perhaps during when it was built, or the 1971 fault must have been, they must have been aware of that one. The 2008 fault, I guess, is subsequent to that. You're confident that this is an independent? I mean, you just said that the same mechanism took place with San Onofre, and the same board sat on that. And
yeah, the same board found in our favor and ordered a full blown hearing. And about that time, the utility decided to shut the plant down forever. So it played a role in the victory. There were other reasons why the Edison Company shut the plant down, economic reasons, and we were making that fight before the Public Utility Commission. But all I'm saying is this is a ray of light. But let me explain the situation in plain English, if I may. Every time that we've discovered another earthquake fault, especially the shoreline fault that was discovered in 2011, the PG&E people simply change the formula for computing it. And basically, it's kind of like if you're playing football and you have fourth down and you only make it to the 20-yard line, they move the goalposts up to the 20-yard line. So basically, they've taken the calculations that were originally made. And when they get a stronger earthquake, they say it's still safe because they use a different method of calculating how much of that earthquake force actually reaches the power plant. And they have fudge factors, and they keep changing them. And all of this has been a closed-circuit game behind the nuclear curtain between the PG&E and the NRC staff, who are very sympathetic to PG&E. And now, the reason I have a slight but real bit of optimism is that the new members of the NRC, and there is a new chairman, by the way, and new members, they have ruled that are convening an independent board of experts that will listen to our testimony and will be able to present evidence, and the staff of the NRC and PG will present evidence, and at least the public will have a chance to be heard for the first time. This is, we've got a fight ahead of us, but at least we're going to have a forum that is, I hope, and trust has an open mind. And of course, all of that going on hopefully will reverberate in the state of California, in which they will, take a harder look at the responsibilities of the state here. The Coastal Commission has to approve a relicensing, and state lands has a role in it, as well as the Public Utility Commission, and especially the State Water Resources Board, which has before it the issue of whether this plant doesn't need to stop killing the fish. I mean, the human beings are next on the list, but they're already killing the fish.
That's because it sucks up 2.5 billion gallons of ocean water per day, which kills the sea life, and then it discharges back the water into the ocean at 20 degrees hotter. So it does that on a daily basis. That's an awful lot of water, and imagine every little...
They're by far the largest killer of fish, of all the power plants. In fact, most of the others have been already required to put cooling towers in. And with San Onofre down, Diablo Canyon now is 80% of the problem. And that's pending before the Water Resources Board. They've been a little busy with the drought lately, so I understand why they haven't decided it yet. But that case hopefully will come to a head. And all of these things point to one thing, that we've invented a better mousetrap now. I mean, it's not as though we're worried about electric lights going out. There's a surplus of power in the state. But I'm not even suggesting that it be shut down overnight. Let's build the solar and wind projects and phase it out one unit at a time, but certainly not consider what PG&E is in the process of asking for, is another 20 years extension on top of the 9 years they have left in this license. And, we don't drive an automobile that's that old. The idea of a company like PG&E, which doesn't exactly have the best reputation in the world for safety, their natural gas pipeline killed 8 people. They just got through being fined $1 billion by the PUC. To have them in charge of a nuclear power plant should make one nervous to begin with. But this one, I wouldn't want to be running it myself. It just needs to retire before it retires us.
Well, David Freeman, I appreciate your time, and I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you for giving me an opportunity. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with David Freeman, who is a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He has had the ear of federal officials since the days of JFK and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under Jimmy Carter and also headed New York Power and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and was the state energy czar responsible for rescuing California from the predations of Enron and Company. David Freeman is the author of Winning Our Energy Independence, and Energy Insider shows how, and he is a senior advisor to Friends of the Earth's nuclear campaign, and they're trying to shut down the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant north of San Luis Obispo on the California coast. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into five big banks being fined while the Republicans are starving the CTFC and the IRS of enforcement funds.
It's the money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He is an Edward R. Murrow Fellow at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and Inspire Fellow at its Institute for Global Leadership. He was the lead researcher on the Tax Justice Network's report, The Price of Offshore Revisited. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Good to be with you.
And following the five big banks having to pay up this $5.8 billion fine, Elizabeth Warren, in a Senate hearing on Thursday, was unimpressed with the fine. She said, "It's business as usual and it stinks. The big banks have been caught red-handed conspiring to manipulate financial markets, and several have even admitted in court that they're felons. But not a single trader is being held individually accountable, and regulators are stumbling over themselves to exempt the banks from the legally required consequences of their criminal behavior." Do you agree?
I absolutely agree. I mean, I think the numbers sound big on paper. $5.89 billion when you add up. Actually, there were six banks, including Bank of America, which got a $200 million fine from the Fed yesterday. But these are the largest banks in the world. They've been caught red-handed rigging one of the largest and most important capital markets in the world, which is the market for currency. Foreign exchange trading is astronomical in size. It's something like $5.3 trillion per day. And the U.S. euro portion of that is about $500 billion a day. And these six banks that were involved, five banks were involved in rigging that market, shameless about meeting. They called themselves the cartel. They said, if you ain't cheating, you ain't trying. They had basically agreed to, dump their trades in coordination with each other, so they would always end up profitable. So this is a, activity that they've dominated for years. And the $5.9 billion of fines here has to be looked at relative to the size of these big banks. I mean, J.P. Morgan has a $245 billion market cap, so the value of their shareholder equity. So this is less than 0.3% of that. A similar story applies to UBS or Barclays or, Bank America, Citibank. These are giant institutions. And so if you told people that the fine sounds a little bit less impressive if you describe it as 0.3% of last year's, the current stock value. And, you know, furthermore, nobody went to jail. No bank lost its license. Corporations in this country do business, by permission of the federal government and by states. They have been allowed to be prime dealers for U.S. Securities. It's an enormous business for them. They advise U.S. pension funds. They're allowed to compete in our capital markets. They benefit from our laws. And yet in this area, they've been caught red-handed. The history here, you know, I've gone back and taken a look at the track record since 1998 for the largest 22 banks in the world. I mean, they have committed every conceivable financial penalty from financial offense, from mortgage fraud and abetting tax evasion to bribery to, illegal to sanctions busting. A grand total for the top 22 banks in the world of about 655 felony-level offenses. And they've paid a total of $246 billion during that period of fines, settlements, private lawsuits, and public regulators. And yet this has had no impact, you know, on their behavior. They just pass the costs along to customers. They are a cartel in this industry, so that's kind of an easy thing to do in this Forex business. They've done similar things with rigging the international interest rate markets, so-called LIBOR market. And I think it's just an example of where these institutions have just become so large as a share of the total market. They're too big to jail. They're too big to influence with these fines. I mean, Jamie Dimon, who's the chairman of J.P. Morgan, is quite shameless about it. Meeting with Elizabeth Warren last fall, he basically taunted her. I said, fine us. If you don't like us, fine us. Business just goes on as usual. So I think that's a slightly different perspective from the point of view that the Justice Department was trying to propagate yesterday. The new attorney general was saying that this was an historic resolution of this case, but in fact, it's very consistent with what we've seen in the past.
Well, again, I'm speaking with James Henry, who's an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist and former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He is an Edward R. Murrow Fellow at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and Inspire Fellow at its Institute for Global Leadership. And he was the lead researcher on the Tax Justice Network's report, The Price of Offshore Revisited. So when you mentioned Jamie Dimon, the head of J.P. Morgan, who one of the five banks that were fined, how can he claim not to have noticed that his top traders were making such incredible bets all the time and making so much money for the company? You can't be that lucky that often, surely, unless there's some chicanery going on.
I mean, it's an excellent question, but he's never had to answer that question, certainly not in front of prosecutor or jury. Bank senior executives in most cases here have survived and or at least been able to retire at a comfortable surroundings. And you would say that from the outside, if you were a shareholder at J.P. Morgan, you'd say, well, either he did not know, in which case it's pretty this is hardly the first felony offense that Morgan has committed during this period. I mean, they have basically settled cases involving many other kinds of activities, including mortgage fraud and sanctions busting and bribery during the last 10 years. Illegal trading was another thing that Morgan had been involved in. So you have to say, well, if he's really a CEO who's active and he doesn't understand what's going on in his organization through this whole pattern of repeated offenses, then, you know, why are we paying him what we're paying him? On the other hand, if he does know, obviously he's culpable. So, you know, this is a kind of a, you know, an interesting puzzle. But I think what we've seen here is that these are banks that have enormous access in Washington and indeed in all the financial capitals of the world to political institutions and to politicians and to the regulators who are, you know, trying to keep them behaving in a reasonable way. And so the influence that they command here has basically made, you know, they're almost having a kind of impunity for their behavior. If you go back to the 1980s, the interesting contrast is with the first Bush administration in the United States, where we have the savings and loan crisis, and something like 880 savings and loan executives, bankers went to jail during that period for various kinds of fraud. In this period, in the last 5 or 6 years since the financial crisis in 2008, we've had very few bankers go to jail, and almost, you know, so not a single senior banker has really done any jail time, certainly not among the top 20 institutions. And yet we see this kind of serial kind of corporate crime wave going on within these institutions. So clearly this is not a matter of just a few rogue traders or rogue individuals who are engaged in this for the first time. This is a pattern of major institutions kind of committing lots of different financial crimes over and over again, to the point where you could almost say these are really criminal enterprises, and they need to be, you know, dealt with proactively by regulation. The current system, you know, where you're after the fact, it takes 4 or 5 years for you to bring these cases. The banks contest them, and they hire the best lawyers in Wall Street and Washington to represent them. And so they drag out the litigation and delay the fines. And so if you look on this as a cash flow perspective, all the profits from the criminal activity, from the market rigging in this case, were realized years ago. And all of the fines that they're going to pay now, first of all, those are not that substantial as a fraction of their value. And secondly, you know, on a cash flow basis, the fines come in way late in the game. So, you know, profits were realized, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. The penalties are realized now. It's a profitable business to be involved in this kind of risk taking. So what we need is a different system that has much tougher proactive regulation, and that's what's at stake now with the lobbying in Washington. The banks have been trying to water down the legislation that was passed in the wake of the financial crisis to toughen up on federal regulation. So as we speak, they're actively involved in trying to dismantle that legislation, that the Dodd-Frank bill, and others. And so Warren is right. You know, we have a system that's basically broken when it comes to penalizing banks. And this is not something we can afford as a country or as a world, because this is a kind of systems risk that a lot of other people outside of the banking industry have had to pay a huge price for.
So, James Henry, some of the settlements were struck with the, for example, Barclays settled with the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. So what was going on with them? Because my understanding is that the CTFC has been starved of funds by the Republicans at the behest of the banking lobby to make it easier for these big banks to gamble on futures, particularly oil futures and also grain, etc. And that's probably the reason, or most likely the reason, why the price of gasoline has suddenly gone up, even though the Saudis have lowered the price to $50 a barrel, and the United States is flooding the market as well as one of the world's biggest producers. So this has nothing to do with the market. So I'm very suspicious about what's going on with the price of gas, and I suspect that some of this, they were, along with rigging currency, they must have been doing something that required them to pay a fine to the CTFC.
Well, I think Barclays got the biggest fine yesterday. It was basically imposed by a combination of New York State and the UK authorities. That was a grand total of $2.3 billion, as well as the Fed. So that's about almost, it's about more than a third of the total fines for this activity. And Barclays was kind of the ringleader and probably the least cooperative of the banks when it finally came to the prosecution. So I think they paid the price for that. What's interesting about Barclays, it's a UK bank. And when you look at the fines imposed by U.S. authorities or the financial settlements here, lawsuits that have arisen as a result of this, U.S. accounts for about 93% of all the fines imposed on giant banks around the world since, 2000. And it's only very late in the day that the Cameron government decided to go after these folks at all. So I think one of the reasons Barclays got hit with such a big fine is that they were embarrassed during this last election year, and they wanted to show that, the UK could be tough on bad banking as well. But, historically, you have American banks like Citibank, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan leading the way in terms of major penalties, but also the Swiss banks, UBS and Credit Suisse, have been caught with involvement in tax dodging, helping wealthy Americans take money offshore. And the UK banks like HSBC and Barclays didn't get heavy regulation at home. So they came, they were caught here rigging the currency market. But, they were also involved in, money laundering for the Colombian cartel in the case of HSBC. So, there's an enormous problem here in terms of regulators in different countries, sort of not behaving consistently. And the U.S. regulators historically have, while they're not they're not doing enough, they're certainly doing more than most of the European authorities.
But in terms of when you just mentioned, James Henry, that a lot of these banks were providing facilities for people to avoid taxes with offshore accounts, etc. And I mentioned earlier that the Republican Congress has been starving the CTFC, particularly Enforcement Division, of funds. They're also starving the IRS of funds. So it's more and more difficult to hire good IRS auditors. And this costs the Treasury and the government. Well, some of the figures are pretty extraordinary. The IRS's figure is it costs the government just tax avoidance in this country, onshore, costs us $440 billion a year in lost revenue. And then the offshore evasion is at least $100 billion. The corporate offshore evasion could be up to $200 billion. I mean, you're starting to get close to $1 trillion here in money that the U.S. Treasury would otherwise have, which would then mean that the country would not have any problems with the deficit, the entitlements, et cetera, and all these programs that are being cut in the name of austerity.
That's right. I mean, I've had this debate with my conservative friends. I don't see why it is a conservative position to defend tax evasion. A lot of this behavior is really outright illegal. And the conservative Congress, the Republican Congress, has chopped the IRS budget again this year. And so it's down about 25%. For enforcement since the year 2010. Every dollar that we spend on an IRS auditor actually pays back, many times over. So it's a relatively profitable activity because at this point it's like shooting fish in a barrel. I mean, it's very hard to compete with zero, which is the effective rate of taxes on people who are evading taxes. So it's basically shifting a lot of the tax burden to the rest of us who are, may not have opportunities to cheat or to avoid taxes, or just, honestly want to pay for the costs of government. I think it's a real contradiction in the conservative point of view between those who feel that we should have a country that's based on the rule of law, that if there are problems that we have with the tax code. We should go to work and change it. But, you know, there's a lot of people who feel we can just help ourselves and move money offshore. You know, big companies have been doing that. It's kind of like shades of gray. You know, they argue that what they're doing is, quote, legal. When Apple moves its intellectual property to low tax havens like Ireland and doesn't pay any U.S. income tax, you know, they argue that their intellectual property, you know, can be parked in Bermuda or Ireland. You know, that's largely a function of loopholes that their lawyers in Washington, and lawyers for other software companies and drug companies, have helped to design. So it's a little bit circular to argue that it's legal when they were involved in writing the tax laws to begin with. I think what we have is a big misunderstanding on the part of most Americans. They perceive themselves as overtaxed, and the fact is that we have the lowest tax share as a fraction of national income of any country in the OECD, except Estonia. You know, Americans are not overtaxed by any means, and what is the case is that the tax system that we have now is much more regressive than it was in the 1980s under Reagan, when the tax-cutting kind of mythology started to begin. Since then, we've seen an explosion of the offshore industry. At the same time, we've seen taxes being cut for companies and for individuals far below the levels that prevailed in the 1970s. And, you know, I think it's just at some point we have to decide we're going to enforce the tax laws that we have, and we're really going to stop all the kind of race to the bottom that's been going on against, you know, other countries like the UK and Canada. When we cut our corporate tax rate, they just respond again. And it just hasn't made the economy as a whole more prosperous.
Well, James Henry, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with James Henry, who's an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He is an Edward R. Murrow Fellow at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, and Inspire Fellow at its Institute for Global Leadership. He was the lead researcher on the Tax Justice Network's report, The Price of Offshore Revisited. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.